This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News, covering the Framingham and Metro West area. Thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. It's Tuesday, May 26th, and in the next hour, we will be bringing you news from the Sunday edition of the Metro West Daily News. This is Paula Simchak. Thinking about a career in law? Harvard University ranks as the best law school in Massachusetts and number 6 nationally, according to the U.S. News & World Report. In total, 8 Massachusetts law schools made the 2026 list. The esteemed Cambridge institution has an acceptance rate of 2.9%, a median LSAT score of 174 out of 180, and a total enrollment of 1,769 students. Full-time tuition is $78,692. The school has a student-to-faculty ratio of about 6.9 to 1, and 97.9% of Harvard students pass the bar exam on their first attempt. To get these rankings, U.S. News surveyed nearly 200 American Bar Association-accredited law schools in late 2025 and early 2026. The rankings are primarily based on employment outcomes, with the remainder reflecting faculty resources, student credentials, and professional assessments. Here are Massachusetts' top schools according to the 2026 U.S. News & World Report rankings. Harvard University, number 6 nationally, is number 1. Tuition, $78,692. Enrollment, 1,769. Median LSAT, 174. Number 2, Boston College, number 20 nationally. Tuition, $72,380. Enrollment, 638. Median LSAT, 168. Number 3, Boston University. Number 24 nationally. Tuition, $71,382. Enrollment, 684. Median LSAT, 170. Northeastern University, number 4, but also number 77 nationally. Tuition, $65,840. Enrollment, 632. Median LSAT, 164. Number 5, Suffolk University, number 128 nationally. Tuition, $64,046. Enrollment, 1,033. Median LSAT, 155. Number 6, Western New England University, number 159 nationally. Tuition, $50,320. Enrollment, 219. Median LSAT, 153. Number 7, New England Law, Boston, which is numbered 168 nationally. Tuition, $63,216. Enrollment, 914. Median LSAT, 153. And number 8, the University of Massachusetts Dartmouth, which is number 171 nationally. Tuition, $33,356 in-state, $43,155 out-of-state. Enrollment, 292, and median LSAT, 152. After the Framingham City Council rejected his first fiscal 2027 budget proposal in early May, Mayor Charlie Sisitsky returned with a $398.1 million spending plan that trims spending across nearly every department, with the largest cuts falling on the schools. Sisitsky's revised draft, presented during Council Finance Subcommittee meetings on May 13th and May 20th, features a 3.5% tax increase and use of $10 million in free cash. The administration initially projected $403.5 million in expenditures against $398.1 million in revenue, leaving a $5.3 million shortfall that forced Sisitsky and Chief Financial Officer Brian Turbitt to identify additional cuts. A 3.5% tax increase would raise the average Framingham homeowner's tax bill to $279.38, bringing it to $8,340 for a home valued at $681,423. To close the gap, the administration is proposing reductions across the police, fire, public works, and school departments, as well as for libraries. Turbitt said the city is working on a department reorganization plan that could save about $263,000, but those changes are not yet finalized. During the May 20th Finance Subcommittee meeting, Turbitt outlined several cost-saving measures, such as reducing police and fire overtime, limiting operating days for branch libraries, and cutting personnel in multiple departments. All of these proposed reductions are going to impact services to the residents, and some of them will maybe make it more difficult for certain residents to access some of the services we provide, Turbitt said during the meeting. They're all reductions that we feel are necessary as we try to close this gap to provide a budget that the City Council can support and will be sustainable and provide the services to a majority of residents in the city. Sisiskit's initial proposal, which relied on a 4.5% tax increase and $14 million in free cash, was rejected by the City Council in a 9-1 vote on May 5th, with many councillors saying they would not support that level of tax increase and free cash usage. Free cash is a one-time revenue source, and several councillors argued that relying on it creates a long-term budget problems. Framingham Public Schools would absorb the most significant reductions with $1.2 million in newly proposed cuts on top of the 81 positions, totaling $4.8 million, already eliminated earlier this year. Those earlier cuts were driven partly by an enrollment decline of more than 700 students in just over a year. But school committee member Adam Freudberg told the Daily News that many positions were cut only to meet city financial targets and not because they were unnecessary. Freudberg warned that the next round of cuts would directly affect student services, including support for homeless students, special education, arts, gifted programs, and English language learners. Some are newer positions when we did have an enrollment surge a few years ago, so they have less of an impact now. But that list of 81 went far beyond just enrollment, he said. That was to meet the mayor's and the city council's financial requests. It's not how government should work, in my mind. We should be funding our schools based on the actual need, not meeting a somewhat random round number of taxation and free cash usage. Freudberg also raised concern about looming deadlines. Teachers must be notified by June 1st if administrators intend to transfer them within the district, and must be notified by June 15th that they are going to be laid off. But without a finalized budget, Freudberg said many educators may be left uncertain about the nature of their employment for the 2026-27 school year. Some councillors argue the city must take a long-term approach to budget sustainability. During the May 20th Finance Subcommittee meeting, District 8 Councillor John Stefanini said school administrators told him that many earlier school cuts were justified by enrollment declines and warned that this year may be the first in a three-year storm for the city's finances. If we want to have stable schools, if we want to have stable public safety, we have to figure out what is not just workable this year, but what is sustainable for years to come, he said during the meeting. Every teacher, every firefighter that we keep this year that we do not necessarily need is two teachers next year, and it's three teachers in 2 years that have to go. Freudberg said he wants to see better collaboration between the city council, the Sisiskit administration, and the school committee, and argued the council has been surprisingly inconsistent in its support for schools this month during ongoing budget conversations when funding needed due to contracts has been known. In past years, they've been strong supporters of schools, and now I'm not sure which direction they're going to go in. Freudberg said, "We can't have it both ways. You can't demand better outcomes for students while simultaneously cutting the people delivering those outcomes." The finance subcommittees for both the city council and school committee are scheduled to meet on Tuesday, May 26, to continue discussion of the budget. Sisiski is expected to present his official budget proposal during the June 2nd city council meeting. A family has filed a lawsuit against the town of Natick, the bus company to which its school district contracts, and a bus driver, alleging their 5-year-old daughter was indecently assaulted on a school bus by an older student. The family, identified as John, Jane, and Child Doe in the lawsuit filed May 4th in Middlesex Superior Court by their lawyer, George King, alleges the school and bus company failed to protect their daughter while downplaying the incident as nothing more than a childhood game of doctor. The suit seeks $1 million, $200,000 for past and future medical and hospital expenses, and $800,000 for traumatic experience, loss of consortium, unknown future impacts, need for long-term counseling, and emotional distress. Named in the lawsuit is the town of Natick, bus company Michael J. Connolly & Sons, which is based in Walpole, and an unnamed bus driver referred to as James Rowe in the lawsuit. The duty of care owed by all defendants was breached when multiple indecent assaults on Child Doe occurred on the school bus while she was being transported to and from school, the lawsuit reads. The defendants have not been served copies of the lawsuit, according to court documents. When reached by the Daily News, town administrator James Erickson declined to comment, citing ongoing litigation. Superintendent of Schools Melissa Spash also declined to speak about the allegations. This matter is currently pending litigation, Spash wrote in an email. In order to protect student privacy and respect the confidentiality of those involved, I am not able to comment publicly on the allegations or details at this time. No one from Michael J. Connolly & Sons could be reached for comment. According to the suit, Child Doe began kindergarten at the Memorial School, which serves grades K through 4, in August 2024. She took a bus to and from school. The alleged indecent assaults came to light on January 12, 2025. Jane Doe's mother was speaking to Jane Doe about a bus driver telling Jane Doe's uncle about students removing pants on the bus and needing more cameras. According to the lawsuit, Child Doe overheard the conversation and said she was one of the children involved. She said a second grade student sat beside her on the bus and had her take her pants and underwear off while being covered with a blanket or coat, according to the suit. When the parents contacted the school department, they felt the school did not show appropriate concern, according to the lawsuit. School officials' solution was to have assigned seating on the bus and to have Child Doe visit the guidance counselor. The family demanded an investigation and eventually filed a Title IX complaint, conducted by Deputy Superintendent of Schools Susan Balboni. The lawsuit called the investigation uneven, unfocused, and sluggish, and did not include an interview with the bus driver. The older girl was also not interviewed because her family hired a lawyer. According to the suit, the older girl's family lawyer said it was just a game of doctor, inspired by a visit to the doctor's office. But the lawsuit alleges that the doctor's office visit that the older girl's family claimed inspired the game of doctor actually occurred after the incidents on the bus began. Balboni found, through the investigation, that the perpetrator called the game doctor and documented the activity at least 10 times between November 2024 and January 2025, according to the lawsuit. Although Balboni allegedly found the conduct pervasive and offensive, she did not find it sexual in nature because of the children's ages, according to the suit. The solution offered was to make sure the two children did not participate in the same activities or classes and to offer more counseling to Child Doe. The family appealed Balboni's findings to Spash, whom they said ignored evidence that contradicted that a child as young as the alleged perpetrator could not conduct a sexual assault, and who wrote several paragraphs explaining why it wasn't sexual in a written denial of the family's appeal, according to the lawsuit. The lawsuit alleges 8 separate counts: negligence, 2 counts of negligent supervision, premises liability, loss of consortium, negligent failure to protect, invasion of privacy, and failure to inform. King, who is Framingham's city council chair, did not comment beyond the complaint. "I think the facts and circumstances speak for themselves," he said. "No court dates have been set. The defendants will have 20 days to respond to the lawsuit once they are served. They must be served copies of the lawsuit within 90 days of May 4th. A new chapter is underway for one of Framingham's longtime roadside staples. Zibbity Doo Dog, the beloved hot dog stand at 160 Speenstreet Street, is under new ownership after Alan and Papanaki McIntosh, owners of Dorgon Eatery in Ashland, took over the business on May 12th. Former owner Roland Houle stepped away after 7 years to pursue a new career opportunity. When Houle first listed the card for sale, the McIntoshes were interested but felt the timing wasn't right. But when a previous prospective buyer didn't complete a deal, they decided the opportunity was too good to pass up. "I've always been a fan of Zibbity Doo Dog," Alan McIntosh told the Daily News. "They just have really good hot dogs, and it's a well-established business with great reviews. It just seemed like a good idea to make sure it didn't go away." The McIntoshes have worked in the restaurant industry for nearly 30 years. They opened Dorgon Eatery, a Japanese ramen restaurant, in 2018. They said the hot dog stand offers a chance to branch out while building on a business with a loyal following. The new owners plan to keep Zibbity Doo Dog signature hot dogs using the same brands and toppings. Since reopening, they've implemented a custom blend burger with 100% Angus beef, fresh-baked rolls, and sausages to serve sausage hoagies. They're also developing new side dishes, such as baked beans, and are considering adding lobster rolls for the summer, though no final decisions have been made. "We're just taking the quality up a couple notches," Alan McIntosh said. "We're basically making what people enjoy and what people want." He said it's been beneficial to utilize their Ashland kitchen for food prep for many of Zibbity Doo Dog's menu offerings. However, the hot dogs, hamburgers, and sausages are all made to order in the truck. The hot dog stand's Pay It Forward campaign will continue, providing a source for free meals to community members facing hardship. The initiative, started by Houle, allows customers to prepay for meals that are later distributed to those who need it. McIntosh said the response to the transition has been overwhelmingly positive, with longtime Zibbity Doo Dog customers returning for their favorites and Dorgon Eatery patrons stopping by to support the McIntosh's new venture. Alan McIntosh emphasized that preserving the experience customers have known for 2 decades remains a priority. "It's just been a great positive response," he said. "Zippity customers want to experience the same thing they've experienced for 20 years, like the same hot dogs, same toppings, so we plan to do that." For now, the stand will remain on Speen Street, which is under agreement through 2028. McIntosh called it an ideal spot given its proximity to TJX corporate headquarters and the Cochetweet Rail Trail. While the new owners will discuss the possibility of expanding to a small luncheon counter on storefront, those ideas remain preliminary as they focus on maintaining quality while balancing both businesses. One immediate goal is renovating the food truck, which is more than 20 years old and in need of repairs. McIntosh said upgrading the trailer is a main goal in the next year or two before considering any potential relocation or expansion. They hope to continue the legacy built by previous owners while bringing their own experience to the operation. We're just happy to be able to take over such an established business and keep it going, because especially in this area, we need more hot dog stands, McIntosh said. Motorists in South Framingham can expect road closures and detours as CSX Transportation completes emergency repairs at two railroad crossings just after the holiday weekend. Work is scheduled for the Hollis Street, Route 126 rail crossing first, followed by the Washakum Street crossing, according to a community announcement. Both crossings are expected to close 24 hours a day during their repairs, with construction taking place from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. each day. Police will be on site to help direct traffic and ensure safety, according to the announcement. The Hollis Street crossing is expected to close starting at 5 a.m. on Tuesday, May 26th, with repairs planned through Wednesday, May 27th. Separate daytime and nighttime detours are planned, according to the announcement. The daytime route will use Claflin Street, Cedar Street, Winthrop Street, Hollis Street, Pine Street, and Hayes Street. The nighttime detour will take a broader perimeter route to reduce traffic on smaller residential streets. On-street parking will be prohibited 24 hours a day on Cedar, Claflin, Hayes, and Pine Streets during the repair period. Residents can park in the Hollis Street Municipal Lot starting at 7 p.m. on May 25th through 6 p.m. on May 29th. Several nearby residential streets will be marked road closed and residents only to limit cut-through traffic and maintain local access, according to the announcement. The Washakum Street rail crossing is expected to close starting at 5 a.m. Thursday, May 28th, with repairs planned through Friday, May 29th, according to the announcement. A detour will direct traffic around the closure using Hollis Street, Irving Street, Alexander Street, Arlington Street, and Washakum Street. Motorists are encouraged to seek alternate routes and allow for extra travel time. Police will be stationed near both sides of the closure to help with traffic flow and maintain safe access for residents. According to CSX, the emergency repairs are necessary for the railroad crossings to remain safe and reliable. An off-duty Waltham firefighter is being credited with preventing several other people from getting struck by a falling tree limb on Wednesday in Framingham before being struck himself. According to a Framingham Fire Department press release, the 39-year-old man, who was later identified by CBS News as Waltham Fire Lieutenant Selvin Sandoval, was walking on Eaton Road at 12:30 p.m. when a limb from a large oak tree fell and struck him. According to the release, witnesses told firefighters that Sandoval saw the tree was falling and warned others, including Framingham Department of Public Works employees and an Amazon delivery driver, to get out of the way. But Sandoval was then struck in the head by a fallen limb. He was initially trapped under it, but got out before emergency personnel arrived, Fire Chief Michael Dutcher said in the release. Sandoval was transported to Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston to be treated for his injuries. He has since been released, according to CBS News, citing the Waltham Fire Department. In the release, Dutcher credited Sandoval's courageous actions. Dover Saddlery, a Massachusetts-based equestrian retailer, announced several store closures and said it may lay off 112 employees this summer. The company, headquartered in Littleton, said in a worker adjustment and retraining notification, WARN, filing this month, that the layoffs and closures depend in part on our success in obtaining funding or selling our business. The retailer sells saddles, riding clothes, helmets, grooming equipment, and other horse gear online and through at least 30 stores across the U.S., including five in New England. In the past week, several Dover Saddlery locations have posted about store closing sales on their individual Facebook pages. In Massachusetts, the Wellesley store said in a post that it will soon be closing its doors. Stores in Plaistow, New Hampshire, North Kingstown, Rhode Island, and Ridgefield and Manchester, Connecticut, shared the same message. Thank you for your support and loyalty over the years. Serving you and your horse has truly been our privilege, and we're grateful for the trust you placed in us, the stores wrote. We've cherished every moment spent helping you pursue your passion and supporting the equestrian community. The post also announced 20% store closing sales. Dover Saddlery was founded in Wellesley in 1975 by Jim and David Powers, top-ranked riders on the U.S. equestrian team, according to the company website. Promus Equity Partners, LLC, acquired the company in April 2022. Dover Saddlery did not immediately respond to a request for comment. If layoffs occur, all jobs at the Dover Saddlery facility at 625 Great Road in Littleton would be eliminated between July 7th and July 20th, the company said in the WARN filing. Some employees may stay on longer to assist with the closure. All layoffs are expected to be permanent, and no bumping rights will be granted to any employees, Dover Saddlery wrote. Affected employees will receive written notice of their potential job elimination. The company has not provided staffing numbers for its individual store locations. The first public reform school for boys in the United States existed in Westboro from 1848 to 1884. It was called the State Reform School for Boys, and it was essentially replaced on the other side of Lake Chauncey by the Lyman School for Boys, which opened 1886 and lasted until 1971. Keep that history in mind, because some believe some of the boys who attended those state-run schools may be buried in unmarked graves at the two sites. They want the state to step up its effort to find out if it's true. John Maynard has spent years trying to determine whether boys who died while attending the State Reform School for Boys are buried along the eastern side of Lake Chauncey. His research has uncovered documents that show several boys were buried there, and he hired a company to use ground-penetrating radar to locate any sign of bodies. Westboro officials said the state didn't appreciate that Maynard did that without going through proper channels. He was slapped with a cease-and-desist order by Westboro to stay off the town-owned land. Today, Maynard says he's allowed back on the property, but he's been ordered to stop trying to locate bodies. He's fine with that, and said he's in the process of turning over all of his research to the state, so it can potentially move forward with an investigation. As for the Lyman School for Boys, Jeff Horton was recently back on the grounds of the school, where many of its buildings remain standing, in a long-neglected state of disrepair. Horton's late father, Rodney Horton, spent many years of his childhood in that reform school, sentenced there by a judge for unbecoming behavior. Standing next to the dilapidated oak building, Jeff Horton pointed to a spot where he said his father was ordered by the school's masters to dig holes. It's in those holes that Horton thinks boys from the Lyman School may be buried in unmarked graves. Even if bodies aren't buried there, it was used as a threat that my father took to his deathbed, said Horton. He feared the Lyman staff would catch up with him and bury him down there. Before he died in December at age 90, Rodney Horton told the Telegram and Gazette that he never really knew his parents after he was abandoned as a young child, bounced around the state's foster care system, and eventually was sentenced to the Lyman School because I did bad. Horton never saw any of the boys buried in the holes that he dug. However, he honestly believed bodies were in them because I dug a lot of holes and kids disappeared. Horton also claimed he was physically and sexually abused by some of the Lyman staff. He was ambivalent about the Oak Building, first saying it should be torn down to erase its painful past. Then he said it should be preserved with a plaque that includes the names of boys who suffered, so the public knows the truth about what happened there. I want it to be a museum and a memorial. If it's raised, then we'll forget what happened here, and we'll be doomed to repeat it. In response to questions about what it's done to investigate the allegations of unmarked graves at the two former state-run reform schools, a spokesperson at the Massachusetts Executive Office of Health and Human Services said in an email that the state hasn't received information about any potential burial sites at the former Westboro State Hospital. The hospital took control of the land after the State Reform School for Boys closed in 1884. As for the Lyman School, the spokesperson noted the executive office doesn't oversee that land, which currently has a mix of public and private owners. As information and funding becomes available, the EOHHS will continue to work with the state archives and other appropriate agencies to address any potential burial sites on property it operates, reads the email. The Massachusetts Special Commission on State Institutions released a scathing report last year that demanded an apology from the Healey administration for what it described as the state's long history of warehousing people in state institutions where many received woeful care. One of the most disturbing issues confronted by the commission is the legacy of deaths and burials in state institutions, it said. It recommended the state investigate and map the potential locations of the graves. The Center for Developmental Disabilities Evaluation and Research, part of the Eunice Kennedy Shriver Center at UMass Chan Medical School, helped prepare the report. Emily Lauer is the center's director. She said the study included Maynard's allegation of unmarked graves at the former State Reform School for Boys as a potential burial site. That's because the report focused on institutions serving people with developmental disabilities and mental health challenges, and lawyers said there is evidence that the State Reform School for Boys cared for people with developmental disabilities. The Lyman School was not mentioned in the report, said Lauer, because it didn't fall within its scope. It's now up to the state to decide whether Maynard's claims will be investigated, said Lauer, and standard procedure is for the Massachusetts State Archives to lead the way. That could be a tough sell because of Maynard's previous actions at the site that weren't sanctioned by the state, said Kate Benson, co-chair of the Special Commission on State Institutions. Benson teaches courses in disability advocacy and its history as an adjunct professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She believes Rodney Horton's claims of digging holes at the Lyman School in the 1940s are plausible because it sounds right for that time period. As Benson sees it, the state must kick in more money and cooperation to properly investigate unmarked graves in Massachusetts, including the two possible sites in Westboro. Following the commission's recommendations, state lawmakers pushed through a law that gives the public more access to archived patient records from state institutions for people with intellectual or developmental disabilities. The records must be at least 75 years old, or 50 years must have passed since the patient's death. Benson called the law a tiny bit of access and hopes more steps will be taken to increase it. Alex Green also served on the Special Commission on State Institutions and said there is precedent for Massachusetts to investigate unmarked graves. One example he cited is the former Dozier School for Boys in Florida, where hundreds of men claimed they were abused as boys in the 1950s and 1960s. Is there a significant likelihood at some former state institutions in Massachusetts for the disabled or for youth that there are unmarked burials? Green asked rhetorically. The answer is yes. There's a significant likelihood. Maynard's goal is to have a memorial at the site where he believes bodies from the State Reform School for Boys could be buried. It's not something that I intend to give up on, he said. Jeff Horton is equally determined to establish a memorial at the Oak Building in memory of his father and other boys at the Lyman School, so that their lives will never be forgotten. His father and others, he said, were trapped at the school, wards of the state with no families to turn to for help, sent there for no other reason than their families had difficult circumstances. The Oak Building is a historical building that just can't vanish, he said. At a time when stepping outside accepted social boundaries was dangerous, a young Massachusetts woman disguised herself as a man in order to serve in the Continental Army during the Revolutionary War. Deborah Sampson, who was born in Plimpton, succeeded in her second attempt to join the Army. She served for a year and a half before a physician discovered her secret. Sampson married a farmer in Sharon, raised a family, and became one of the first women to give lectures in America. In her later years, she recruited the assistance of her friend, Paul Revere, to petition Congress on her behalf to receive a pension. Today she is celebrated as a patriot and a pioneer for women's independence. May 23rd is recognized as Deborah Sampson Day in Massachusetts. A celebration will be held from 1 to 4 p.m. on Saturday, May 23rd at the Sharon Historical Society at 16 High Street. She was a woman way ahead of her time, said Steve Connolly, a historian with Sharon Historical Society. Over 200 years later, we're still talking about her. In April, the Postal Service released a stamp honoring Sampson as part of its Figures of the American Revolution campaign. Despite Sampson's impressive lineage, her mother was a great-granddaughter of William Bradford, a Mayflower passenger and second governor of Plymouth Colony. Her childhood wasn't easy. After her father left, Sampson's impoverished mother sent some of her children, including Deborah, to live with relatives. Sampson first lived with a cousin, then stayed with a minister's elderly widow in Middleborough, where it is believed Sampson was taught to read the Bible. Later, she was an indentured servant for the Thomas family, also in Middleborough, and further educated herself by learning from the family's sons, who shared their schoolwork with her. At age 18, no longer bound to the Thomas family, she earned a living as a teacher for summer classes and as a weaver over the winter. By many accounts, Sampson was unusually tall for a woman of her time, standing about 5'7". She was considered plain in appearance and described as being somewhat masculine. She looked like a lot of the 18- or 19-year-old male recruits, with her long hair pulled back, which is how young men often wore it, Connolly said. Historian Candace Warren Wongsrich-Chandalay of the Massachusetts Historical Society said monetary compensation may have been Sampson's incentive to enlist. It's quite possible she was also fully invested in the cause, Wongsrich-Chandalay said. In 1782, as Timothy Thayer, Sampson joined an army unit in Middleborough, but was recognized by a neighbor and had to repay a stipend she had received. The local Baptist church to which she belonged withdrew its fellowship upon learning of the deception. Undeterred, she enlisted in Uxbridge a few months later as Robert Shurtleff and joined the light infantry company of the 4th Massachusetts Regiment. She was stationed in Bellingham, then Worcester, along with about 60 men. This was an elite unit, Wongsrich-Chandalay said. The men had to be a certain height and extremely physically fit. She was leading raids and was as courageous as the men who served next to her. That summer, Sampson was shot in the thigh and cut by a sword across her forehead after participating in combat near Tarrytown, New York. Though she is said to have begged her comrades not to take her to a doctor, a fellow soldier ended up doing just that. A doctor treated her head wound, but she left before the physician could tend to her leg, Wongsrich-Chandalay said. She ended up removing the musket ball herself with a penknife and sewing needle, but as she later explained in a pension application, her leg never fully healed. Maintaining her disguise, she served as an aide to General John Patterson in 1783, then went with a contingent of soldiers led by Patterson to Philadelphia per orders of George Washington to deal with a rebellion of American soldiers. It was in Philadelphia in the summer of 1783 that Sampson fell ill with fever and lost consciousness. Dr. Barnabas Binney discovered Sampson's true identity after removing her clothes to treat her. He did not reveal her secret and instead took her home, where his wife and daughters, along with a female nurse, could care for her privately. In September 1783, as soldiers were preparing to be sent home, Sampson was given a note from Binney to deliver to Patterson that revealed who she was and recommended an honorable discharge. Patterson gave her the discharge, as well as money to travel home and some words of advice. She had served a year and a half disguised as a man. Now 23, Sampson went to live with an aunt in a section of Stoughton, later annexed to Sharon. She continued to dress as a man. She met Benjamin Gannett, a local farmer, and they married in 1785, living in the Gannett family farmhouse in Sharon, where she had three children. The couple also raised a local orphan. As a way to earn more money for her family, Sampson gave lectures about her military experiences. She was eventually commended for her heroism and received a pension after calling upon her Revere to reach out to Congress in her support. Paul Revere was one of the most powerful Federalists in the country, so to get something from him would have been a benefit, Connolly said. His words carried a lot of weight. Sampson died of yellow fever at age 66 on April 29, 1827, at her home in Sharon. She is buried at Rock Ridge Cemetery. Her story has been inspiring people over the generations, Connolly said. A World War II Liberty ship was named for her, the SS Deborah Gannett. That doesn't happen for just anyone. She left an amazing legacy. 7 Fall River teens and 2 Medway teens were arrested mid-Tuesday, May 19th, in connection to a melee at Second Beach in Middletown. They are facing charges after a gathering of 1,200 high school-age people at the popular Rhode Island beach led to violence, according to reports from WJAR. Tuesday was the hottest day of the year so far, with temperatures breaking records and hitting 93 degrees at TF Green Airport, according to the National Weather Service. This incident occurred about 2 hours before a disturbance at Narragansett Town Beach around 3 p.m., during which 3 people suffered minor stab wounds. 2 adults were arrested on charges not related to the stabbings. Police were called to Second Beach at 12:45 p.m. Tuesday to monitor the large crowd. Officers placed one man into custody after allegedly acting disorderly toward others in the group. Another man then assaulted the officers, prompting the crowd to become aggressive, police said. Police were forced to deploy pepper spray after the crowd refused to disperse. Several more people were then arrested in the parking lot for disorderly conduct and obstructing officers. The disturbance prompted a large police presence at the beach, including 16 Middletown police officers and 20 from Newport. The Fall River teens arrested faced the following charges. An 18-year-old woman was charged with disorderly conduct and obstructing an officer. Another 18-year-old woman was charged with simple assault, disorderly conduct, and obstructing an officer. A 19-year-old Fall River man was charged with disorderly conduct. 2 17-year-old boys were charged with simple assault, disorderly conduct, and obstructing an officer. 2 17-year-old girls were charged with disorderly conduct and obstructing an officer. According to reports, 18-year-old from Medway, who allegedly admitted to driving under the influence, was charged with felony assault and DUI, first offense, after attempting to flee the area in a car and striking a police officer. The officer was transported to Newport Hospital. 2 suspects were also treated at Newport Hospital for exposure to pepper spray, the report states. A second suspect from Medway, 18, was charged with disorderly conduct and obstructing an officer. A waste hauler based in Blackstone was convicted of presenting falsified records pertaining to the repair of a failed septic system in Bellingham. Michael L. Marchand received a 2-year prison sentence, suspended for 3 years with probation, Tuesday, May 19th, in a case brought forward by the Office of Attorney General Andrea Campbell. Marchand was hired by a building supply company in 2024 to remove and dispose of 99,000 gallons of septage from its Bellingham property. The Attorney General's office claimed that Marchand presented the Bellingham Board of Health with records that include false information. State contend that Marchand also failed to indicate the final disposal site of the septage. Marchand, 55, owner of Marchand LLC, Marchand Septic, and 3 related companies located in and around Blackstone, claims an error in the paperwork he presented to the Board of Health led to the state charges. Marchand told the Telegram and Gazette that he had already corrected the errors and paid a $750 fine to the municipal board when the state filed charges against him. Marchand was convicted of 12 counts of uttering false public documents following a 2-day trial in Norfolk Superior Court earlier in May. "We will appeal," Marchand said. In addition to the suspended sentence, the court ordered Marchand to provide enhanced notification to the State Department of Environmental Protection of all activities related to transport and removal of septage, and to comply with DEP-mandated inspections of all septage operations. State officials noted that raw septage can transmit disease to humans and animals and also contaminate soil, groundwater, and surface water. In October, the AG obtained a preliminary injunction against the owners, Marchand LLC and 25 Elm Street LLC, as well as Marchand and his son Michael Marchand, that prohibited them from using their property as an unauthorized solid and septic waste transfer station. In a lawsuit that remains ongoing, the state contends that the Marchands used the property in Blackstone as a storage and disposal facility. In its request for the injunction, the state alleged that the family illegally used construction and demolition debris, as well as wood waste, to fill and expand the usable area of the 14-acre tract where the business is located and where the owner lives. Massachusetts' highest court has upheld a ruling in favor of a former South Shore fire chief who says he was pushed out of his job in 2015 in retaliation for lodging internal complaints. Former Marshfield Fire Chief Kevin Robinson was awarded a settlement of $1.4 million plus fees, which are still being decided in the courts. Anne Glennon, an attorney for Robinson, said the final number will be significantly more than the original award amount. The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court on May 15th ruled in favor of Robinson and upheld a 2024 decision by a Plymouth County Superior Court jury that town officials retaliated against Robinson and their actions were extreme and outrageous. Robinson said that as one of nine siblings who grew up in town, he feels as though this ruling clears his family's name. It's been a long 11 years waiting for this, and as the jury verdict indicated, I did the right things for the right reasons in compliance with the laws, Robinson said by phone Wednesday, May 20th. It's vindication for doing the right thing as I was required to do. Lawyers for the town officials, named as defendants in the case, argued that Robinson resigned because he was facing credible disciplinary action for violating state ethics rules. Rocco Longo was town administrator at the time of Robinson's departure from the department. Jason Crotty, an attorney for the town, did not respond to an email from the Patriot Ledger. Robinson in 2015 opted to retire from the Marshfield Fire Department amid allegations that he violated the state conflict of interest law. Selectmen placed Robinson on paid administrative leave in March 2015 following a closed-door session to investigate charges of criminal misconduct, including the state conflict of interest law. Robinson later announced his retirement. Executive session minutes obtained by the Patriot Ledger through a public records request at the time showed that Marshfield Firefighters Local 2568 filed a grievance regarding concerns about the training and readiness of then-firefighter Shauna Robinson Patton, the chief's niece, and how the situation was handled. Labor Counsel John Clifford said he felt Chief Robinson acted poorly and veered from the rules of the ethics disclosure when handling union concerns about the qualifications of Patton, according to the meeting minutes. Robinson later confirmed that the investigation stemmed from how he handled disciplinary and employment-related matters and grievances that he was statutorily and contractually required to handle as the fire chief. Once he retired, Robinson filed a complaint in federal court alleging age discrimination, retaliation, failure of town officials to investigate claims of discrimination against his niece, breach of contract, and defamation. The complaint filed in federal court was ultimately dismissed, which was upheld in appeals court. Robinson's attorneys then refiled in state superior court in 2020. Robinson claims that he was given a take-it-or-leave-it situation where he was forced to either retire or be fired after he raised concerns about gender discrimination against his niece within the department. Instead of investigating that claim, he said officials initiated the internal investigation and put him on administrative leave as part of the effort to force him out. Lawyers for the town argued that Robinson voluntarily resigned and therefore was not subject to adverse treatment under the Age Discrimination in Employment Act of 1967. The court ruled in favor of Robinson in 2023. After the Superior Court ruling, the town sought a judgment notwithstanding the verdict, which is when a judge sets aside the jury's verdict and enters a judgment in favor of the losing party without a new trial, which the judge denied. The town appealed the ruling, and the state Supreme Judicial Court added the case to its docket in September 2025. Oral arguments in the case took place in January 2026. In its appeal of the lower court ruling, the town claimed that the judge erred in denying the motion for a judgment notwithstanding the verdict because the evidence was insufficient to find that the town retaliated against Robinson. The town also argued that a new trial was required because the judge improperly instructed the jury. In its decision, the justices wrote, "We conclude that there was sufficient evidence for the jury to find that the town retaliated against Robinson because he complained of gender discrimination." The justices said the judge's instructions were not prejudicial because the instructions as a whole were adequate. Robinson joined the department as a call firefighter in 1978 and became a full-time firefighter in 1979. He worked his way up the ranks and was appointed to the position of fire chief in February 2003. Robinson also chairs the State Board of Fire Prevention Regulations and previously served as president of the Fire Chiefs Association of Massachusetts. Michael Davidian is a fourth-generation farmer, and he remembers his grandfather telling him years ago that if you're in the farming business, you can expect to lose one of your crops every year due to unforeseen circumstances. Davidian thought he lost more than that when a quick and powerful storm rumbled through parts of central Massachusetts late in the afternoon on Tuesday, May 19th. Wind gusts that reached 60 miles per hour temporarily bent the tall metal flagpole of the Davidian home on Ball Street, according to Davidian's account of what his father, Edward Davidian, witnessed when the storm blew through. The father and son run Davidian's farm, which has been in the family since 1918, and the May 19th storm is an example of the constant uncertainty that the family and all farmers live with daily when it comes to Mother Nature and her potential impacts. Good and bad years on the financial balance sheet depend on her mood, and state officials report no long-term damage to central Massachusetts farms from this week's storm. Besides the wind, it dumped a considerable amount of rain, resulting in what looked like a cascading river flowing through some of Davidian's planted fields. Mike Davidian thought he would lose a bunch of crops that day, including the 3,000 summer squash plants put in the ground earlier that day. In just 30 to 45 minutes, nearly 2 inches of rain fell at the farm, and all that Mike Davidian could do was marvel at the sight. He recorded the scene on his mobile phone, even though it could wipe out his plants and result in a terrible financial hit. "It was unbelievable. I was about in tears," he said in an interview with the Telegram and Gazette 2 days after the storm. Davidian posted the video on Facebook and was heartened by the outpouring of support from the community. Online comments like, "Oh no, sorry Mike," temporarily eased his anxiety. Not fully, however, because Davidian couldn't sleep that night, worried about what awaited him in the morning when he inspected his fields. To his surprise, the damage was relatively minimal. State agricultural officials watched Davidian's video and received no reports of long-term damage at central Massachusetts farms. Davidian estimated he lost 5% to 10% of his corn, tomato, and zucchini crops, and all those summer squash plants were relatively unscathed. Considering that his losses could have been much worse, Davidian gladly said, "I'll take it." Davidian doesn't know why he dodged a weather bullet. Unsure of changing weather patterns that some leading scientists link to climate change can explain the May 19th storm. Davidian has worked on the farm for decades, and for more than 30 years he didn't recall the farm losing any of its apple and peach crops due to weather-related events. Times have changed because Davidian said the farm lost its entire peach crop twice in the past 10 years. This year was the third time in the past decade that the peach crop was reduced, and Davidian thinks this winter's extended deep freeze was likely to blame. Another extended cold snap cut into the farm's apple crop 2 years ago. Dave Reed, the executive director of the nonprofit Central Mass Grown that supports the work of local farms, said in an email that human-driven climate change will make severe weather more common and disproportionately impact small-scale farms like those in Massachusetts. Whether or not climate change is behind the intermittent crop reductions at Davidian's farm, Michael Davidian isn't taking any chances, saying the family is tapping into government grants to protect crops and improve efficiency. Additions include a new irrigation system and heating equipment in the greenhouse that accessed grants from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. State grants helped pay for a new packaging facility and refrigeration equipment. Other steps to safeguard crops include covering some varieties with a fabric that provides 2 to 3 degrees Fahrenheit of protection. It's not a lot, but Davidian said it can be the difference between healthy and wilted plants. Davidian is also planting cover crops like rye, wheat, and clover in the fall, but it's not for food. It's an anti-erosion measure. Where the government falls short, said Davidian, is insurance payouts to protect farmers against weather-related losses. It's better than nothing, but it's not going to make you whole. The way crop insurance works is it's generally available through the United States Department of Agriculture, according to Edward Davidian, the executive director of the USDA Farm Service Agency in Massachusetts, a position appointed by the Trump administration. A farm has to have a 40% crop loss before the insurance kicks in, according to Davidian, and the payout is a percentage of the remaining 60%. He said the family didn't make an insurance claim on the recent storm damage at Davidian's farm because the impact was minimal and there's enough time left in the current growing season to replant and recover what was lost. Standing at the cornfield where he recorded the May 19th flood that washed over his plants, Michael Davidian still couldn't believe that most of them survived. "Some of them got beat up, but I think they're going to come back. All in all, I'll take it." Nearly 1,000 residents filled the Lincoln Sudbury Regional High School Gymnasium on Wednesday, May 20th, for a lengthy and highly anticipated special town meeting. Newly appointed town clerk Lisa Davis said the 956 voters vote process was about 4 times the typical 200 to 300 attendees at previous town meetings. The meeting began about 8 p.m., an hour later than scheduled, due to parking delays, and adjourned at 12:06 a.m. Thursday. Residents were asked to vote on 4 citizen petitions, with Articles 3 and 4 generating the most debate. Article 3 proposed establishing recall procedures for town officials, allowing voters to remove an elected official before their term ends. The article passed 677 to 261. Article 4 called for a symbolic vote of no confidence in the Sudbury School Committee. That also passed 452 to 295. Public attention to the vote of no confidence began in March, when a citizen petition circulated by residents generated more than 500 signatures and raised concerns about the school committee's governance practices, transparency, and adherence to state laws. The petition targeted four of the committee's five members, then-chair Karen Jones, current chair Jessica McCready, Elizabeth Seuss, and Julie Durgan Sickrey. According to the warrant, petitioners also cited concerns about conflict of interest rules and potential open meeting law violations. The actions of the current school committee have demonstrated a pattern of conduct inconsistent with the standards of transparency, integrity, and ethical governance that Sudbury residents expect of their elected officials, the warrant article read. Wednesday's vote was non-binding and did not remove any officials from the committee, but served as a public statement on the board's recent decisions. Ahead of the special town meeting on May 5th, the Sudbury Select Board voted 4-1 to oppose the article. Member Dan McCarty was the lone supporter. Board members said the allegations lacked factual support and warned that the petition was contributing to division in town. "I've been very disappointed by what I've seen as far as a citizen's petition and bringing this forward," said Select Board member Lisa Kuchekdijian during the board's May 5th meeting. "Baseless allegations like this are very, very serious, and I don't take it lightly. This has caused division in our community. People have been fed misinformation about the committee, about one particular member of the committee. If there was any weight or credence to any of the allegations, I would have cause to consider them. But there's zero here." After Wednesday's no-confidence vote, McCready, who was appointed chair on May 18th as part of the committee's annual reorganization, said in a statement to the Daily News that the board will continue to work to serve the community despite the outcome. "We respect the right of residents to participate in town meetings," she said. "This committee has worked hard to protect class sizes, support students, expand transparency, improve budget oversight, and advance a long-term vision rooted in academic excellence and equity. That work does not stop because of a non-binding vote. Our commitment remains to Sudbury students and the future of our schools." Tensions between the school committee and residents have been building for more than a year. One of the central disputes involved the committee's handling of Superintendent Brad Crozier's contract. The committee held executive sessions to discuss a potential buyout, with Crozier later announcing he would resign at the end of the school year in a joint statement with the committee on April 13th. Throughout these discussions, Crozier received strong support from teachers, administrators, and many residents. Other disagreements have centered on after-school programming and the committee's approval of equity and inclusion initiatives, including policies related to LGBTQ+ student support. These efforts have been welcomed by many residents, but questioned by others who feel the committee has prioritized certain initiatives over others. It doesn't take a lot of effort to find videos on social media of people rescuing ducklings that fall into storm drains. But what people don't realize, according to Alyssa Giaquinto of Giaquinto Wildlife Center in Marbo, is many of those ducklings don't survive much longer after being freed. Due to the presence of cold water and storm drains, they're easily susceptible to hypothermia. For the past few months, Giaquinto has been thinking of ways to prevent ducklings from falling into drains in the first place. "This time of year is peak duckling season," she told the Daily News. "Ducklings are falling into storm drains left and right. Many times it's the same storm drains every year, because mallards often use the same nests. One idea Giaquinto came up with is to use garden netting." She said she has worked with Marlboro City officials to start a pilot program where she installs a 2-by-2-foot piece of netting over storm drains and secures it with zip ties. The netting would then be removed once ducklings make it to a nearby lake or pond. "The holes are large enough that water can get through, but the ducklings can't," she explained. Giaquinto has not installed any netting yet this year, but she's asking residents to reach out if they know of any duck nests. She said she would come out, inspect the nest, and the likely path to the water. If a path to the water goes past the storm drain, she would install the netting. Once ducklings and adult ducks make it to the water, she would remove the netting. Giaquinto hopes residents in other communities also reach out. If they do, she said she would contact their community about her idea. Should she obtain permission, she can go through the same process she plans for Marlboro. "It's just such a simple idea, and it could save so many duckling lives," she said. Anyone who wants to report a duck nest can contact Giaquinto at giaquintowildlifecenter@gmail.com. "I haven't had any leads yet," she said. "I really hope we can get this started and save some lives." Poor management, inadequate oversight, and an entrenched culture of over-the-top paramilitary training make the Massachusetts State Police Training Academy more dangerous and less effective than many of its peers, a third-party study released May 20th found. The $600,000 study, ordered by Governor Maura T. Healey, following the 2024 death of Worcester trainee Enrique Delgado Garcia, yielded more than 100 recommendations and prompted the agency to indefinitely delay its upcoming annual academy, which had been scheduled to start in June. We are fully committed to implementing these recommendations and to maintaining the focus needed to strengthen the academy over the long term, said Colonel Jeffrey Noble, who decided to suspend the academy until dozens of reforms he identified as crucial are implemented. Noble, at a press conference May 19th, said the department would honor the memory of Delgado Garcia, who died following an academy boxing exercise, by meaningful action. The colonel, who came on the job just weeks after the recruit's death, largely declined to comment on the manslaughter charges a prosecutor brought against four of his troopers, citing the open case. The 112-page report that led Noble to order reforms, produced by the International Association of Chiefs of Police, did not examine the specific circumstances surrounding Delgado Garcia's death. The report, styled as a comprehensive operational and cultural assessment of the state police's sprawling new Braintree Academy, only appeared to allude to the death once in passing. However, in scrutinizing injury rates and operations for the past 10 training academies, the report was highly critical of the paramilitary tactics offered at the academy, including the boxing program. The report found the academy has high injury and dropout rates that are attributed to widespread failures in policy and practice. Policies on paper lay out safety protocols and require injuries to be promptly reported. However, in practice, the report said, drill instructors often go off script and trainees feel pressure to keep injuries to themselves. Authors of the report, who observed training exercises at the academy, reported witnessing senior officers who appear to approve of training tactics they deemed excessive, lacking purpose, and demeaning to the trainees. A shift toward sustainable, job-relevant, ethically sound fitness practices with protected recovery periods, comprehensive safety oversight, formal concussion awareness training, and established culture of safety is essential, they wrote. Reform must prioritize evidence-based programming, eliminate punitive physical training, ensure adequate recovery, expand qualified staffing, and create systems that proactively prevent injuries rather than reactively responding to them. The report also questioned the value of head strike training exercises, including boxing, which state police May 20th said they would end permanently. The department said it would also implement a number of other safety reforms before starting the next academy, including some that, the report indicated, had been suggested 20 years ago. The state police academy has faced scrutiny for decades. Two recruits died there in the 1980s. No charges were issued in those deaths, the Boston Globe reported. And in 2022, the department reassigned staffers after unauthorized bear crawls on hot pavement. The state in 2006 released another report, commissioned after allegations of hazing, that made a series of recommendations for reforms. In many key areas, little has changed or improved as a result of the recommendations provided in that report, the May 20th report says. The 2006 report, the Boston Herald reported, criticized oversight and training, highlighted personnel shortages, and said the academy failed to adequately screen recruits to ensure they had the physical and mental strength to withstand the rigorous 26-week program. The 2026 report echoed all those critiques. It noted the academy relies on a single fitness staff member and focused at length on deficiencies in the screening process. The authors said the department lacks appropriate fitness benchmarks and does not properly assess the physical and mental capabilities of applicants, allowing underprepared trainees to enter training. This dynamic results in a high number of dropouts and injuries that could have been preventable, said the authors, who faulted the department for not allowing properly documenting injuries or studying trends to avoid them. The report found that many of the same injuries, including to the legs and shoulders, recur as a result of unduly harsh training regimens, including unscheduled and punitive exercises. The use of physical training as a form of punishment is explicitly discouraged by leading fitness and tactical training bodies, the authors wrote, calling the practice not only physiologically unsound, but also ethically problematic. Reform efforts must center on the adoption of fitness protocols that are legally defensible, job-specific, and health-promoting, they added. While the 2026 study faulted police for not improving in key problem areas identified decades ago, its authors also faulted the 2006 report for recommending the department keep some high-stress tactics they found to be inappropriate. Authors said the 2006 report reported many ritualistic and outdated exercises aimed at subjecting trainees to stress for fear that dialing back the intensity would put a stigma on new officers of not having succeeded in the same manner as all other officers of the department. The authors found many of the stress tests serve no legitimate purpose, including one in which trainees were shouted at that, the authors wrote, were watched with tacit approval by high-level command staff. An often repeated goal of some members of the Academy staff is to be a preeminent law enforcement training agency that delivers cutting-edge training, the report found. However, continued reliance on tradition, outdated rituals, and a desire to exceed the stress exposure experienced by prior classes will stifle this goal. The 2026 authors said that while stress exposure and purposeful training exercises is an important component of training, such exercises should prioritize skill development, psychological readiness, and mutual respect over indiscriminate stress exposure. They recommended the department strike a better balance with their stress exposure, something Noble vowed to do before opening another academy. Noble said he did not have a timetable for when enough reforms might be implemented to begin the next academy. Other reforms that will need to be implemented include establishing a civilian academy director of training position, establishing baseline physical and psychological screening protocols, reinforcing a safety-first culture through training, and building stronger systems for injury tracking and recruit readiness. Noble, in a background interview with reporters invited to headquarters May 19th, thanked the International Association of Chiefs of Police for the report and said implementing its recommendations was a priority. A condition of the invitation was that reporters not quote Noble directly on his answers to questions about the report, though they could report the information he provided. Reporters were given a physical copy of the lengthy report at the same time Noble gave quotable opening remarks that could be recorded. Recording of his background answer sessions was barred. Noble, in answering questions from reporters, said he could not speak for why prior leaders did not implement previously identified reforms, but vowed he would ensure transparency and improvements moving forward. Noble said a key part of the reform effort will be to find the right balance when it comes to rigor. While he said he supports developing a balanced stress training curriculum, he noted that such training is essential to ensuring the state produces troopers capable of handling life-threatening situations. He noted, for example, that a third-year trooper recently helped stop a potentially disastrous mass shooting attempt on Memorial Drive in Cambridge by confronting the gunman as he fired on helpless motorists. Noble stressed that there will be tough training at the academy, but said it will be thoughtful, purposeful training approved through the chain of command. Asked whether he thought the reforms, if implemented sooner, may have prevented Delgado Garcia's death, he said that's likely an unanswerable question, noting there is much the department will learn as the criminal case unfolds. Noble said his relationship with the police union is strong and that he was confident the department will support the changes being made. Framingham will celebrate Pride Month with its 8th annual Pride flag-raising ceremony at 2 p.m. on Sunday, May 31st at the Memorial Building Plaza, according to a community announcement. The event will feature Alfred Green, director of the LGBT Asylum Task Force, as keynote speaker. The task force supports LGBTQ asylum seekers with housing assistance and connections to various resources, according to the announcement. Reverend Debbie Clark of the Edwards Church in Saxonville will serve as master of ceremonies. Other speakers include Mayor Charlie Sisitsky, Framingham's Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Officer Jesse Edwards, Library Trustees Chair Heather Klisch, a representative from Out Metro West, and student speaker Rain DeBrush. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Paula Simchak. Thank you for listening.
This is Bird Note. Masonville Cove in South Baltimore is a special place to study birds. Once a dumping ground for sediment dredged from the harbor, the cove is now a popular urban wildlife refuge, says ecologist Sharon Dorsey.
And we have seen a return of wildlife, not just mammals, foxes, otters, but a lot of bird species.
Sharon is part of a licensed research team that's monitoring bird populations at the cove with a scientific catch and release technique called bird banding. Sharon weighs and measures the captured birds, then fits each with a uniquely numbered metal band.
It's like a bracelet that they'll wear for the rest of their lives.
That info is recorded in a global database. So if the banded bird is encountered at another station, researchers will know that it spent part of its life in Baltimore. And that's important
because not many stations are set up in urban environments. We are essentially trying to describe what birds are doing in these urban spaces. You don't think that they would thrive, but in fact, they find food and mates and other things for their survival.
Sharon says that over time, This data can reveal which species take refuge at Masonville Cove and how habitat restoration benefits urban birds. This is Blackbirders Week. To learn more, follow the hashtag Blackbirders Week on social media and visit birdnote.org. I'm Dara Miles-Wilson.